The little fellow that I've got in my hand here, most of you would recognize him as E.T. Does a little fellow like this have satanic effects on your child?
I have
current geek!
Hello, everybody, and welcome back to Current Geek. This is the Current Geek Film Festival, a special monthly look at the greatest movies of all time from a geeky perspective. I'm Scott Johnson, he's Tom Merritt, and this week we're talking about E.T., which stands for The Extraterrestrial.
Ouch.
Oh, you did a really good impression of him. Also, did I emphasize extra too much, probably? It's just extraterrestrial.
Extraterrestrial.
Yeah. It's not like he's a bonus non-earther.
I believe this is when I learned the term extraterrestrial.
Oh.
I know Close Encounters of the Third Kind came out before this. I saw the movie. I had the photo novel, and I feel like I should have known extraterrestrial. But when E.T. came out, that's when I remember being like, oh, that's a thing, extraterrestrials.
Yeah, this was a 1982 film. So long history for Tom and I. We would have been young bucks, like 11 or 12.
Young bucks.
Impressionable young men who, were waiting for whatever Spielberg had up his sleeve. This would have been after the first Indiana Jones movie.
After Close Encounters, after the first Indiana Jones movie. In fact, this was, we'll talk about it a little more. This is sort of the outcome of a failure of a direct sequel to Close Encounters that was going to be more of a horror-ish film.
Yeah, which is crazy. They also had plans for a sequel-ish movie that was also kind of a horror-ish film.
In a different way.
Yeah, in a very different way. Both literally and it would have landed that way, I think, for audiences. But instead, what we got was E.T., and that's all we got, which is...
Steven Spielberg came up with the idea for this story. And like we said, it came out of some other ideas he had been working on. But the screenplay was written by Melissa Matheson.
Oh, all right. I don't know her. Should I know her?
You should know her because she wrote a movie E.T.
Oh, hey, she's famous for the film E.T.
Well, and she's not real famous. I think a lot of people just think Spielberg made it because he talks a lot about the ideas being drawn from his childhood and movies from his childhood and experiences growing up in the suburbs and even some of the sadder stuff about, his father and parental relations and all that. But Melissa Matheson, she wrote the screenplay for BFG, if you know that.
Oh, the newer, another Spielberg collaboration, the BFG.
Yeah, she wrote the screenplay for Twilight Zone, the movie.
Ooh, that was, hold on, I'm going to just say, because I remember it right, it's an American Werewolf in London director. And the guy died making it, and it was all bad. It was all scary because the guy died. I can't think of the name.
Joe Dante and John Landis. John Landis. The directors.
There you go. Yeah. John Landis is one thing.
And she wrote one of the segments. She wasn't the, there were several writers on that.
She's been around, done some stuff. But I didn't know that going into this viewing. I'd actually watched this relatively recently, probably in the last year and a half or 18 to 24 months for FilmSack. And we did it as one of those, like FilmSack is, a lot of people think it's just, those are just old bad movies to make fun of. And sometimes that's true. But even recently, we just watched Skyline, which is a recent bad movie. But sometimes we watch good movies from all periods of time. And definitely E.T. was on the list of, why don't we watch a good, culturally significant film that holds up or that has influence beyond its years or whatever. And we didn't talk at all about the fact that she wrote that. In fact, up until this viewing for Current Geek, I thought it was a Spielberg joint, up and down, his ideas, his written story. I just never paid attention to it. And there it was. And that surprised me.
No, in fact, the script only went through two revisions. He basically thought it was just about perfect when she handed it in to him. They deleted an Eddie Haskell kind of character who was a friend of Elliot's. And I feel like they kind of pushed a lot of that stuff onto the older brother. Mm-hmm. And the chase sequence was created. That was not in the original screenplay. Also, Spielberg suggested having the scene where E.T. got drunk.
Yeah, a memorable one because he was home alone.
Yeah.
And he got into the fridge and got a bunch of beer.
And because he was connected to Elliot, Elliot started to act drunk. And
I remember when I was younger, there was complaints by parents saying that how easily inebriated the creature was bad for us as kids to see that. Like all parents
because
do.
What? That would mean that we would be cheap drunks? What?
I have no idea. Like, to this day, I don't actually know what their fear was.
Yeah.
There was nothing about it that made me go, ooh, I can't wait to get drunk like that. Like, I don't.
Yeah, exactly. Like, it was not presented as a cool thing. It was more like, oh, he made a mistake, a horrible, horrible mistake, because he didn't understand that beer gets you drunk.
Yeah. I'm going to just put it out there that I think baby boomers, our parents' generation, are terrible at spotting actual things in the media that are going to harm their children, because they were wrong on all of them.
Possible.
All the ones that we're freaking out about. That's why I played that clip at the top of the show. Some old TV dude talking about how He-Man and all this stuff's bad for your kids. And one of them was E.T. toys. And they were always saying, this is satanic.
How
that's
satanistic will this make your child?
Yeah. What will back-masked lyrics and Beatles songs
10%
do?
10% satanistic? 30%?
I mean, they sort of started it.
Like that guy, he kind of talked about it like it was, you know, radiation. Like, how much Satanism will your child absorb from this toy?
Yeah, I like the fact that he was going down the, he was almost going to give us a percentage of Satanism coming off of that toy. But this is that era, and I'm so glad this era exists, because there's this period of Spielberg filmmaking that endures today that is evident in a generation of filmmakers who grew up with Spielberg as the guy in the theaters that they aspired to. If you can't watch Super 8 and not be reminded of E.T. And by that, I mean tropes like young kids who are just trying to have fun and be creative and running around doing whatever, and they're kind of latchkey and their parents aren't really paying attention to them. That is such a Spielbergism and such an E.T.-ism. And then to have those kids experience supernatural phenomena in their lives and how they deal with it is very E.T. You could say that Super 8 was just a straight-up homage to E.T., and I loved Super 8.
Yeah, and Stranger Things, too.
Stranger Things, great example. Yeah, Stranger Things is basically E.T. the show in a lot of ways. And it's great. Like, I don't want to overstate it, but I think that must have just had a real impact. There's a slice of that era of entertainment that is carries forward today, and when I see it, I know what it is. I feel it. It's like, this is like E.T. You know, like there's something captured there. It's hard to explain.
Night Skies was the name of the more horror oriented sequel to Close Encounters that eventually got turned into E.T. And Stranger Things does feel like kind of a mashup of Night Skies and E.T.
Sure.
It's got some of the fun part of E.T., but Night Skies was a story where a malevolent alien terrorized a family, and that definitely is the kind of thing you hear about in Stranger Things as well.
Would you like to see what that may have been like a Close Encounter sequel?
We know Super 8 was J.J. Abrams' Chat Room.
Yeah, we know that.
We were saying it was like a Spielberg.
Oh yeah, anyway, like if you cannot watch Super 8, they must have been confused, but you can't watch Super 8 and not go, this is a love letter to Spielberg. It just is.
Yeah.
And it's a really well-made one, I think. And you could even say maybe a little too derivative of Spielberg. I don't know. There's criticism, certainly, but what a cool movie that is. I love Super 8. Anyway, part of it's because Coach Taylor's in it, and I'm a sucker for that guy.
He's kind of good.
Just do whatever. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Anyway, back to the point. If they ever did, like, would you be down? Are you down with the idea of a beloved classic being returned to? Let's forget about Indiana Jones for a minute. Being returned to like one of these, like what would an E.T. sequel look like today?
The Haunting of Hill House.
I mean, is that the direction they'd have to go, or do you think they could even capture that?
Well, it's because the kid who played Elliot was not a kid anymore, and he was in The Haunting of Hill House.
He was great in that. I loved him in that.
Yeah. I am not someone who feels on principle that you shouldn't remake stuff. Yeah. There's some people with knee-jerk opinions out there like, stop remaking things. Remaking things is bad. I'm not one of those people.
Yeah.
E.T. does strike me, though, as something that doesn't need more story. And this is directly in contravenes the 11-year-old self who saw E.T. in June of 1982. who wanted more immediately. As soon as that was done, I was like, where'd he go? Mm-hmm. What happened when he got there? How's he doing? Let's check in. I need more ET. Mm. But now I feel like I don't want to know, because it's only going to let me down. Yeah. I just like the ending of, I have to be there, you have to be here, it's just the way things are. That's a real life lesson. Mm-hmm. And it's such a poignant end that going back to the story, I think it would undermine the ending of the original.
Yeah, I just know it's tempting for them. Maybe in another 50 years, this is the kind of classic you return to and remake. But it's still really good, you guys. Like, it holds up. It feels like a movie set in the 70s and 80s, but made to look like it is. In other words, it just feels like a really well-made period piece. It doesn't feel out of time to me. I think that's partly due to an incredible score, maybe his best, John Williams' best work. I think that visually it holds up. I think effects-wise, the whole point of this thing was to show the alien as little as possible and do it in dark corners. And, you know, if you didn't know that Drew Barrymore was all grown up now, she just looks like a fun, smart little actor girl playing the sister.
And she is so Drew Barrymore, even at that age. Like, she is totally who she is.
Totally. Yeah. Like, I feel like that
person. Apparently, she got the role by saying she wanted to be the leader of a punk rock band. And they were just so charmed by this tiny, tiny little girl saying that. They're like, yep, you're in.
Yeah. But it's so, like, I don't know. Like, I don't get tired of it. And I know there's the, you know, the one controversial turn it took was during a, not a remastering, but a re-edit, re-release, whatever.
Yeah, they did some re-releases a couple times.
Yeah, VHS version of the movie has all the walkie-talkies are turned into, or sorry, all the guns are turned into walkie-talkies that the FBI G-Men guys are chasing him with during the bike scene. And he now says he regrets that change, but at the time he was feeling very strong about, you know, gun violence being a problem, and he didn't want to be a part of, you know, the culture that that had guns all over the place in his movies and that sort of thing. He now regrets that. He thinks he should have stuck with the original. But I don't know if you've ever seen this, Tom, the cut of that, that where it's no guns and only...
I have, and I should say, it has been... This is the first time I've seen E.T. since I was in my 20s.
Oh, man. All right.
Yeah, it's been a long time. But the guns versus thing, it never even occurred to me.
Yeah, it's a very weird thing.
I know it was a thing, but... I'm like, yeah, okay, why would government agents be out there with guns anyway if they're secretive? Like, they wouldn't have their guns drawn.
Yeah.
Like,
and that was part of his original justification for doing that, or, you know, changing those and CGIing them out, is that, hey, they wouldn't chase him with guns anyway. They're not going to aim these at these kids.
Put it this way. I didn't see the need to change it. Mm-hmm. Like, I'm like, yeah, it's fine. Okay, so maybe they're packing heat, whatever, because they think there's an alien invasion. But I also didn't have a problem with it being walkie-talkies. That would also make sense to me.
Yeah, the biggest problem with it right now is it looks very like, it's almost like George Lucas called him up and said, Steven, check it out, I'm making these, I'm doing these things in 1997 to my old movies where Jabba's walking around and like a slug.
No, here's what it is. It's like, hey, I realize E.T. passed Star Wars to become the highest grossing film of all time. And I realize that you're only going to break your own record with Jurassic Park in 1993, but I have a great way for you to not make as much money on the re-release.
Yeah, how about this?
It looks so you can't pass me. Yeah. Again.
Maybe he was just trying to trick him, yeah. But
no,
it's
I don't think that is it. But I had forgotten until I was prepping for this show that E.T. passed Star Wars mm-hmm. at the time.
Yeah, it did. It did really well. Like, this is a monster hit. And I remember seeing it 4 times in the theater, just begging my parents to keep going. I loved it.
I probably saw it a couple times. I don't really remember. I didn't love it as much as Star Wars, but I liked it.
Yeah. And that's where I wanted to get around to is where did you, so you know where I landed. How'd you feel when you were 11 or 12?
I thought it was great. There was a part of me that wanted more space stuff. Mm-hmm. It all took place on Earth. And I was like, that was a cool spaceship at the beginning and end. Mm-hmm. Like, that was great. That's what 11-year-old me wanted. Right.
Right.
And even 12-year-old me, because this came out like 2 weeks before my birthday. But I wanted more space stuff. but I liked E.T. And my brother and I, my brother was like five at the time. We both, you know, walked around going, ouch, and, you know, touching each other's wounds. We didn't have wounds, but, you know, we pretend that story, you know, phone home, I'll be right here. Like, right. We totally played the E.T. game for a while, but it never stayed in my head as much as Star Wars.
Oh, yeah, that's true for me, too. In fact, to me, it felt like it's like dressing up. It's like an extension of Star Wars. Like, even the movie has him trying to show E.T. how to play with action figures. He's got Hammerhead and
Boba he's got all Fett the Star Wars. There's so many Star Wars things and Jaws references. Did you catch the Jaws references?
I totally did. Like, this movie liked to celebrate, him and George and everybody's work at the time. And then also, it was like the first movie I remember seeing where they had the level of product placement this movie had. And I didn't think of it as product placement at the time, which I think is probably what they intended. But Reese's Pieces became incredibly popular as a result of this film.
Everybody knows Reese's Pieces with E.T., right? Like, that's the famous thing. And and if you know a little more, you know that Eminem refused to be part of the movie. And so Spielberg turned to Hershey and said, what you got? And they're like, we got this new Reese's Pieces. You want that? And they're like, great. And that, you know, made a big deal out of Reese's Pieces. But stupid M&Ms, you know, that should have been them. Everything else in there is the top brand, or at least arguably a top brand, right? Yeah. Like, you have brand names all over this thing.
Coke's in there, the beer brand I forgot, but
Coors, I think it was Coors.
Coors. Yeah. Yeah. Like, it just, my memory is it's one of the first movies I saw where there was a recognizable brand on everything.
I mean, someone's dressed up as Yoda for the Halloween thing.
Right. Yeah. The total Star Wars reference to the Halloween stuff. But my point about all of that is now we're used to that, right? Like, you see it all the time. Oh, there's a MacBook. Oh, there's everything's a Honda for some reason in this movie. Where that's weird. And
oh, the speak and spell even.
Oh yeah, the speak and spell is in there. So they had other toys and stuff too. And that robot is a specific brand of robot. I forgot the name, but all of that stuff was maybe one of the first times I'd seen that. And it acted as set dressing for my world. Like, my world were all of those things and those brands and that stuff. So that house felt like our house. That neighborhood felt like our neighborhood. Me and all my friends on our BMX bikes were like Elliot and all his friends on their BMX bikes. And there was a weird kid and a funny kid and a good-looking kid. And, like, all the stereotypes and the archetypes were – it felt like it was for me. And I think that's why I responded to it. Plus, we were the age of the kids.
I don't think I realized it at the time, but watching it now, I'm like, oh, yeah, no, this is all stuff I definitely knew.
Yeah, and it felt like it knew us well. Like, it wasn't just faking it. It wasn't adults trying to go, hey, kids, check it out. There were plenty of movies like that, and they don't hold up as well.
And they did the Tex Avery thing, where the adults are never seen from the waist up, right, except for the mom in the first half of the movie.
Right. Yeah, even Peter Coyote's character, who has the keys. And that was the other thing. And I know this isn't actually, I don't think this was ever confirmed, but Peter Coyote's character, where he shows up at first, he's just a set of keys and a waist. Like, that's all you get from him. Later on, you get to know him, but when I was seeing the movie as a kid, I remember everyone saying, hey, you know, that's supposed to be the kid from Close Encounters. He's the one that went on the ship. So now he's all interested later in life, trying to figure out, you know, what's real and what isn't. And they left him here. So now he blah, blah, blah. And I never could find anything anywhere where Spielberg or anybody else would verify that. But in my head, that
5 years later, though.
Oh, is that all? This is supposed to be 5 years.
I mean, Close Encounters was in 77, I think.
Yeah. But when you're a kid, time's like a big fluid puff of smoke. Like, I didn't make any so to me, I was buying it. I was like, oh yeah, that's if that kid grew up and now he's trying to find out more. And then I get as an adult and I realize, no, probably not, it was just a character who's kind of, you know.
I want to say something right now before we get too far down this road, which I know we're pretty far. I found this to be the cheesiest, greatest movie that we've watched so far.
All right, give me the
I mean, this is, I believe, the place where Spielberg gets the, oh, that's so Spielberg from.
Yeah.
Like, there are, it is alternatively like deep and poignant. Mm-hmm. The scene where they're at the dinner and alluding to the divorced mom, and Elliot, you know, doesn't realize why what he said was so upsetting. So well done, so subtle, mm-hmm. and well directed, and just tells you everything you need to know about this family without having to explicitly say any of it.
Yeah.
But that teen game scene that's right before is so oppositely cliche. Like, everything about it is just like a cliche about teen games and all, oh, this is what the boys say, and ha ha ha, get the pizza, who ordered the pizza, you get the pizza. And I found myself bouncing back and forth that way, mostly loving it, don't get me wrong,
sure.
mostly finding it amazing, but every once in a while there'd be a piece that was just so corny. And I was like, oh, wow, yeah, no, this is Spielberg, right? Like, that's what he's known for. And I feel like this is the source of that.
Yeah, I agree. I agree with you. And it would show up a lot in all of his other movies, a lot of his movies, not all of them, but he wouldn't really shake that until Schindler's List, that notion.
None
that,
of the suspense scenes worked on me anymore either. And,
yeah.
And it wasn't just because I knew what was coming, but... maybe when mom found E.T. in the closet and he's hiding, you know, amongst maybe that one.
The
works,
stuffed animals. I always thought she was super stupid for not noticing him in there, but
everything felt really signaled and you knew what was coming next.
Yeah.
With a few exceptions.
Do you remember though, when you were young though, there was like scenes in that thing where he first discovers him, for example, outside and he's chasing him and he's got this flashlight. Mm-hmm. That's scary.
I didn't know what E.T. I didn't know if E.T. was good or not.
Yeah.
So yeah.
That stuff's terrifying.
Also, I had entirely forgotten that E.T. dies. Like that whole scene where he's like turned white.
Yeah.
I'm like, I remember he got sick.
Yeah.
And then I remembered that to save him, he had to get back on the ship. But I had suppressed that. I was like, oh my God, he full on dies? Like his heart stopped and died. Like, which is another point where it's very cheesy Spielberg to the odd, but all he needed was love from his spaceship to revive him.
Yeah, it was all very maudlin at that point.
Yeah, yeah.
But that's funny you say that. It's very burned into my brain because I think in the theater I bawled my eyes out as a kid during the scene where he passed, and I got so exhilarated when he came back. Again, soundtrack has a huge part of this, I think, because it still works on me today. I still feel those feelings. But
yeah, yeah.
But when he, totally. Just, it's so burning in my head that he became this like white turd in the sun kind of alien that was just like, oh man, he looks terrible. Like he looks terrible. And also,
was it just the version I was watching? Did it always leave a rainbow in the sky when his ship takes off?
I think it always left a rainbow in the sky.
Wow. Okay.
But that's what you're talking about, and you're right.
Yeah.
You're right.
Yeah.
Like, that's when he started
And final
that.
Thing, yeah. Why do the people that come into Elliot's house have not only spacesuits on, even though everyone else who comes later has a traditional hazmat suit, why do they have spacesuits with space shuttle patches on them?
They're trying to fool you into thinking these were the aliens themselves. Like, they didn't show faces. They just had breathing.
All right, it's a little
on the sleeve. It's a little cheaty. But I remember it being effective when I was 11. Like, oh my gosh, they're coming to him and they're in these tubes. What is that? Like, it got hairy there for a minute.
Yeah.
I think they, you know, sort of mission accomplished. But with our eyes now, we can't see it the same.
Can't unsee it. No. It's a great movie. Don't get me wrong. Like, it belongs on this list. And the good beats are so good.
Mm-hmm.
All the work they did with E.T. as a practical effect holds up, in my opinion, really well.
Mm-hmm.
Over the years, the E.T. was based on Rimbaldi's painting Women of Delta, which led him to give the creature, Rimbaldi also designed the creature, that extended neck. The face was supposedly inspired by Carl Sandburg, Albert Einstein, and Ernest Hemingway, which might explain the drinking. Kathleen Kennedy, who produced this, the Kathleen Kennedy of Lucasfilm, who produced this, visited the Jules Stein Eye Institute to study real and glass eyes and hired the Jules Stein Eye Institute staffers to create E.T.'s eyes so that they would look real. And then they used a lot of voice actors for E.T. to make a lot of the grunts and groans, but the majority of E.T.'s voice comes from Pat Welsh, who smoked two packs of cigarettes a day and gave her voice the quality that sound effects creator Ben Burtt wanted. She spent 9.5 hours recording her parts and was paid $380.
That's all?
Yeah.
She should have got paid more for that. Because there are moments, like when he's running through the house going, or whatever. Like, yeah. Give that woman some more money.
Well, and not all of that was Pat Welsh. So some screams and grunts and groans came from other sources, but she did the majority of it.
That's pretty low rent, though. Jeez Louise.
$380. I mean, in 1982 dollars, that's more than it is now, but still not very much.
Sure, it's like $1,000 now or something, isn't it? Something like that? I don't know.
Yeah. Should we talk about how this film was going to be a failure?
Yeah, let's talk about how it was going to tank.
The head of Columbia Pictures Marketing and Research and Development, Marvin Antonofsky, concluded that E.T. had limited commercial potential. Columbia's Worldwide Productions' John Vetch felt the script was not good or scary enough to draw a crowd. Mm. It went to Universal for $1 million. They basically said, yeah, here, Universal, give us $1 million. That's nothing between friends. You can have it. Do whatever you want with it. Just give us 5% of whatever the film's net profits are. You go make Spielberg's little pet E.T. project. Go knock yourself out. Mm. That same John Vetch, who felt the script wasn't good enough or scary enough, later said, I think in 1982, we made more on the 5% of E.T. than we did on any of our other films.
I love that. Take that, you bunch of idiots. I mean, I think it's shocking that, film executive world hadn't figured out by this time that Spielberg was going to be, or already was, one of the most bankable creators in Hollywood. Like, how
well, that's
you
probably why they
that.
Asked for the 5%. They're like, well, it is Steven Spielberg.
It must have even been, but that guy made nothing but gold every time he put a movie out, and they were all rife with problems. I was reading, I saw Close Encounters kind of recently, and was reading all this trivia about that thing, and it was rife with problems and issues, and you know, went over budget and over time, and the studios were balking, and everybody was afraid it was going to tank, and no, it was like critically acclaimed and made a lot of money, and then he kept just doing it. Every movie, like, had he not had Indiana Jones right before this, maybe I could see them being a little more skittish, but how those guys could possibly not want to just hitch their wagon to him everywhere he went, beyond me. Even his worst movies, like Hook, my opinion, I know a lot of people like Hook, I hate it. But Hook made a ton of money.
Yeah.
You know, like...
hindsight is always 20/20. And I always want to point out that, you know, you like to think that you would have not thought the same thing. But we only ever hear the stories of the successes that the executives said were not going to succeed. We never hear about the ones that they said wouldn't succeed and they made anyway and flopped.
Yeah, that's true.
it just doesn't, those don't make the history books.
It's like the, the documentary on Netflix about toys, the toys that made us or whatever.
Yeah, yeah.
There's a really great section in there about Mattel and anyone else of note turning down Star Wars toys.
Oh, right.
Sure, yeah. That they were going to tank, and then they end up going with Hasbro, whoever it was. I forgot now. Kenner.
Well, it's every successful author's story, right? J.K. Rowling is the most recent example I can think of because we're reading her right now for Sword and Laser. But every successful author got turned down at least 30 times, right?
Yep.
Because that's the way the industry works. There are too many people trying to get published, and it's there's no exact science for determining what's going to be successful. So successful authors get turned down a lot before they finally get picked up and become successful. But it's a selection bias because you only hear about the successful ones. And since every author gets turned down 30 times or so, you're going to hear that same story about pretty much every author with a few exceptions. So it's really not stunning, but it's just the way our brains work, I guess, to think about it that way. And again, you never hear about the people who got turned down 30 times and never got published because their books weren't any good.
Well, in my world, it was always cartoonists you'd hear about. Syndicated cartoonists going through 400 rejections before somebody would finally discover that Bill Watterson was amazing.
It's just the way it works.
Yeah, it was just part of that business. And so it's all very different now. But I suspect filmmaking is a lot like it used to be. I don't know that much has changed. It's still a lot of discovery and rejection and... Oh my gosh,
who
I can't believe.
And timing and
like,
you know,
more than any other
uncontrollable factors.
Exactly. Yeah. If you could, you know, if J.K. Rowling was starting today, she could probably self-publish something. And if it was good enough, she could gain some, you know, the kind of traction she'd need to take to the next level. just like some YouTubers start out small and then now are directing major motion pictures or doing something big. You know, Jordan Peele's a good example of that. Like, it's just a different time now, but I feel like filmmaking really hasn't changed. So, you know, I wonder who they're turning down today that we're all going to look back in 5 years, again with our selection bias, and go, I can't believe you turned down so-and-so, who now makes the biggest movies of the world.
I think the other thing is, I don't think Spielberg knew E.T. was going to be the biggest movie to make the biggest money-making movie. Spielberg just wanted to make a movie about aliens. And his original idea, the Night Terror, whatever, it wasn't working. Night Skies might have been super successful. Imagine if Night Skies gets made as a sequel to Close Encounters, you know, and does well. And sure. He never makes E.T.
Sure.
That's a perfectly plausible scenario. Mm-hmm. He didn't make E.T. because he said, I have designed a movie that will make the most money of any movie up until now, even bigger than Star Wars. He made E.T. because he's like, well, I still have this Night Skies idea. And I've always wanted to tell a story about, you know, kind of based on my childhood. So Matheson, do something like this and get back to me. Oh, you made a real good script. Well, let's make it. This will be fun. Oh, Columbia doesn't want to do it. Well, Universal, you want it? Great. All right, let's go make it. They didn't know. They didn't Babe Ruth call their shot. They just made a movie they wanted to make.
Yeah. Sometimes, I don't know, there's a lesson in that. The lesson isn't, you know, it's not even, you might make it huge if you just focus on making your movie. That's not even the lesson. The lesson is, get it made however you want to get it made. If it's a thing you want to do, do it your way, make it, and then go. And then move on to the next thing.
Make it good.
Make it good.
You know, do the things that you think are important to make it good. Mm-hmm. But you don't need to try to design it to be successful. Generally, if that's your aim, you don't end up making something that's that good because you compromise on things because they're like, you need to make it scarier, right? Mm-hmm. All the people in the know who tell you the thing that worked before are telling you the thing that worked before. And if you want to have the unexpected hit that's going to really capture imagination, you need to hit on something that, you know, that the people who know what worked before wouldn't know would work.
Yeah, and it's also funny that Stranger Things, a bona fide hit, like a gigantic hit, doesn't exist if not for that legacy.
Right, because that's the inspiration, right?
It is, and it doesn't feel ripped off. It feels properly mined.
Homage.
Yeah, like it's additional material from an era that had this magic in it, that had us out on our bikes with no cell phones and no way to talk to our parents, that had that magical thing going on in kids' imaginations. And they figured out a way to not only harness that, I think, for a whole new generation of, you know, 12 and ups, but also for adults who remember that time fondly. And they just, it's a gigantic hit. And it doesn't exist without, again, Spielberg just settling for, oh, I kind of like the script and yeah, I can throw in some of my own childhood experience. Like, you know, it's just such a funny thing. Yeah. Like, just make a thing, make it really good. If the world notices, great, you might be the next Spielberg. If the world doesn't, well, at least you still made a thing you really liked and you did a great job at it. There's something there. There's some lesson there. I know he's like an auteur and amazing. And
And sure, you can't go on to lead a campaign, the Academy of Pictures against Netflix and try to get him disqualified from Oscars. Mm-hmm. But you've still made a thing you like.
Yeah, people are mad about that. Yeah. Well, I mean, big shock. I keep saying things like that. It sounds so dumb coming out of my mouth. People are angry on the internet about it.
But they are. They really are.
Yeah. I think he's wrong, but it's a different show for a different topic.
Welcome to Cord Killers.
Yeah.
The other thing I noticed is a lot of times you see these films, and E.T. is just set in present day, right? Yeah, it's set in 1982 because it was made in 1982 or 81 or whatever. Yeah. It doesn't look like a movie from 1982. It looks like a period piece to me.
Yeah.
Right?
I would agree.
Like it feels like someone's trying to make a convincing 1982 movie and did a really good job, which is, on the one hand, you might say, well, of course, Tom, it was 1982. Real easy to make a 1982 looking movie when it's actually 1982. Mm-hmm. But they didn't do things that dated it. Mm-hmm. The cuts and the scenes and the way it's shot and the way people act and talk doesn't feel like, oh, like Saturday Night Fever, for instance. Definitely also a period movie, but feels very dated. Feels of its time to me. Mm-hmm. Because it's exaggerating parts of the culture. And I think one of the cool things about E.T. is it didn't exaggerate its current culture. It focused on the personalities and the characters, and the period that it's in is just set dressing. It's just what's wrapped around them, which is one of the reasons it works so well. And one of the reasons that you had that reaction of, at the time, oh, this is, I know this world. This is me. This is my friends. Mm-hmm. Because they weren't trying to create a world. They were using the world that actually existed.
Yeah. And the net effect is it holds up today and feels like a well-made period piece today that was still made in a modern way, because they weren't trying to accentuate those things or play on trends that wouldn't last or any of that. They just time capsuled an era. And just happened to be making a movie in that era and captured it really well. So when you look at it now, you're like, yeah, the 80s, you know, like there it is right there on film without them having to. It's not a knowing thing. They just made it and it holds up. But it reminds me.
It's not like, you know, the sitcoms like the Goldbergs where like everybody's got a Rubik's Cube around their neck so that you know it's the 80s.
Right? Yeah, that's one way to do it. But, you know, you're totally right. Like if there is a Rubik's Cube, it's properly placed and properly seen, it's not pointed out in a movie like E.T. Like it's just the life people were living, and it really holds up that way. But I cannot emphasize enough how important I think music is in this case, because this would have been an era in filmmaking when everyone else outside of the Spielberg Lucas world were still like, let's go a little synthy, let's have you know, Jerry Goldsmith do some kind of synthy thing, and this is a movie that in anybody else's hands might have had a synthy late 70s, early
like
80s approach.
Things.
Like Stranger Things does.
Yeah.
To say, hey, look what time we're in, or
we're,
hey, this is the hot
in
thing.
In the 80s, hear that synth.
Yeah, but when you go orchestral, suddenly everything's better. Like it's just, or I should say, not necessarily better, it is better, but it's
timeless.
More universal, timeless. It'll go forever. And no one will ever go, oh, this soundtrack doesn't hold up. No, that'll always hold up. That'll always sound good. I don't care who you are. And we'll have trends up and down. Some movies, we'll go long time hip hop with all our movies, and then long time weird backtrack guitar riff stuff for movies. But we'll always come back to orchestral arrangements, and we'll always sound right. My personal feeling.
I wonder if that will always be true, or whether there will be a point where music evolves to where it, you know, it just orchestral sounds like it's from those few centuries where orchestral was popular. It's a fascinating thought, because I'm not trying to undermine your point. I think you're right that right now orchestral lasts across the decades. Mm-hmm. But it is fascinating to wonder, like, I mean, orchestral music was new at some point the, you know, 1600s, 1700s.
Right.
And has lasted for a long time. Or, you know, forget rock and roll. Orchestral music will never die.
Mm-hmm.
Orchestral music is here to stay.
I mean, maybe. I don't know. Like, you make a good point. Things change. But I think if you're going to give these guys any credit, then it was to see far enough ahead of them to know that the synthy trend they were in was about to be out of favor in a big way.
Or at least that it was so new that it would be too fresh for the sort of universal story. And I will say that I do believe Spielberg was trying to tell a timeless story. Even though he was setting it in modern day, he was drawing on his own experience as a kid in the 50s. So, you know, it's that kind of makes it have to be timeless to work in both eras.
Sure. We talked about the similar conversation about Star Wars, and of course, there's John Williams again, but I think it's possible that one day John Williams would be just looked at as the most important.
We need to scan his brain.
Oh, man. Like, it's so across the board. I don't know if anything's more influential than film than his scores, because if you think about it, from then forward, it's just, it all changed. And not that things couldn't get interesting or weird or a little bit different. Like, Hans Zimmer's done some really different stuff, and there's definitely been
Andre
options.
Previn, who just passed away, also, you know, predated John Williams and was amazing.
Yeah, but there's going to come a day. I don't look forward to it, but the day that John Williams is someone that says, oh, John Williams isn't with us anymore, that's going to be a serious, like, look back at of an impact of a dude in an industry like film.
It's you cannot argue with his impact.
No, it's gigantic.
I doubt you can make a convincing argument that his music isn't great.
Yeah.
And he absolutely scored some of the greatest movies of all time.
Sure. So keep emulating him, everyone. That'd be great.
Don't immolate him.
Don't emulate. No, emulation is no good. Flagellation, forget it. We're looking just...
I want to return to to something you brought up towards the beginning of the show, an E.T. sequel.
Yeah.
Spielberg and Matheson wrote a treatment, never a script, but a treatment for a sequel. Now Spielberg decided against pursuing it because he felt it would, in his words, do nothing but rob the original of its virginity.
Okay.
Which is a different feeling than I had for why I didn't want a sequel, but that's what Spielberg said. The sequel was tentatively titled E.T. 2 Nocturnal Fears.
Ugh.
It would have, I know. Makes me think of something that would definitely not have been in this movie.
No.
It would have shown Elliot and his friends getting kidnapped by evil aliens and follow their attempts to contact E.T. for help.
Not calling home this time,
calling E.T. at home.
Calling long distance.
Yeah.
Okay.
What's E.T.'s number? I don't know. Is it still in the speak and spell?
Interesting. I mean, do you think, was this over years that this was being bandied about? Did they decide not?
I think it was fairly short, shortly after. In July 1982, they wrote the treatment. It was during the actual first run.
And so it was hot off of the huge success that they were having. I mean, I personally am really glad that they didn't.
City and E.T., new phone, who dis?
That's a really good, if we did titles for these film shows, we'd do that one. Yeah. That's pretty good. But I guess I'm glad. I mean, it's easy to say I'm glad they didn't, but maybe they would have pulled it off. I don't know. Like, maybe they would have, but I would
like to think that it would not have ended up being called Nocturnal Fears.
I mean, I get that it's like, oh, nocturnal dreaming, blah, whatever, but it's got, there's connotations there. Those kids are all hitting puberty. That's just weird.
There's no reason to.
Yeah.
Night skies. Why didn't you just use night skies?
Yeah, night skies. ET2, night skies.
The John Sayles movie was going to be.
There you go.
The Close Encounters sequel. You probably had the rights to it. Yeah. ET2, night skies.
Yeah, I'd be fine with that.
That's fine. Just fine.
Here's what they would do today. Today, if this was a hit film in theaters, you'd have some kind of Disney direct or Disney Channel animated series or something. They'd do something for kids.
In fact... weren't there some,
there may have been,
what are the derivatives, other portrayals, a theme park ride, public service announcements, E.T. was included in the Phantom Menace.
The
race.
Oh, right. He was in the Senate there. Yeah.
Lego Dimensions, E.T. appears as one of the playable characters, but it doesn't seem like there were ever any animated E.T.s. That's weird. I wonder why.
I just think they would have totally done that today. At the very least, we would have seen something. I mean, it was parodied to death. Everybody loved doing parodies of E.T. They have a shot in here of the guns and the replaced walkie-talkies. I need to look at this again. Oh, yeah, look at that. It's so dumb.
Ouch. You shot me.
It's so dumb. It looks dumb. You're right. That's it. Do they ever do cereal? Let's see. No cereal. I used to love
video games.
Yeah, they had plenty. Oh, yeah, famously.
Well, they had the Reese's Pieces thing, so they probably didn't need to do cereal. They just license out the image for the Reese's Pieces packages.
Yeah, the most infamous, of course, of that Atari game, which was terrible and also tanked and got literally buried.
Literally buried.
In the New Mexico desert, which no one was really sure if it was true or just this urban legend or whatever, but... In recent years has been dug up. There's a couple of cool documentaries about it. Just a great little storied mess there. But it also, there's a lot of background. I would recommend people go kind of dig some of that up, literally dig it up. Go look at the history of Spielberg trying to work with the very new medium of video game entertainment, because it's a really interesting look at a guy who saw the potential in that stuff very early and tried to get his hands all in it. It didn't really work out great, but he would very much champion video games as a extended art form for years, still to this day. He's he's had other projects and other cool things, and big video game guy Spielberg.
There was a sequel book written by William Kotzwinkel called E.T. The Book of the Green Planet. published in 1985, in which E.T. returns home to the planet Brodo Asogi, is demoted and sent into exile, and then he attempts to return to Earth.
Oh, that's a depressing story.
Yeah, and it also, it's, again, this underlines my point, where you just want to leave it with him saying, I have to go home and be with my people. You need to stay here with your people, but we'll always be friends. We'll always have Earth.
Yeah.
You know, and the idea that E.T., you know, goes home and gets exiled, sort of, it's like, well, then why were you, if your planet was so crappy at that and you knew you might, you know, run afoul of the law, why would you want to go home? Like, it starts to undermine some of that.
Yeah.
I think it is E.T. for me has one of the best endings because of the way it's handled.
Yeah.
Despite the rainbow.
And part of it is they don't tell you all that. Like, they just, we know he wants to get back to wherever home is.
Yeah.
He's gained a very rudimentary English proficiency so that he can communicate a couple of things.
And we know his people are just botanists. They're not invaders. Right. They're not, you know, they just wanted to collect some plants and go.
That's plenty of world building. Let my imagination fill everything else. You don't need to have him go into exile. What are we, freaking the Phantom Zone and Superman 2? Like, this is dumb.
You have violated our rules by contacting the humans.
It's got a very Star Trekian kind of dumbness to it.
Yeah, E.T.'s people had the prime directive and he violated it.
It's a mistake.
They are not a warp capable civilization.
It's a mistake. Don't do it. All right. Well, that's E.T. and I enjoyed it a lot. This is my second viewing in a couple of years and then probably third in 15 years. And
I think I last watched this in the early 90s.
Yeah, it was pretty great. Yeah, don't forget his Amblin Entertainment and pretty much his brand moving forward was, you know, the logo was this kid with an alien in a basket silhouetted on a moon. Like, that became the thing right up until DreamWorks.
Hilarious that the chase scene, I guess that's not the chase scene, though. That's when he's just riding into the woods to set up the phone.
Right.
But the chase scene wasn't even in the original script. The chase scene is like, that's key to the end, right?
Yeah. I wonder if that sold a bunch of speaking spells, do you think? Like, that did
probably,
well.
Probably, yeah.
Because that was
so. We never got one though.
Yeah, I think we did.
We had a Mr. Professor.
of course, a small
little yellow one that was calculated.
Of course, you freaking had a Mr. Professor. I don't know why.
I don't know.
There's something about that is totally a Tom Merritt. Like, you and I could be kids at a party, and I'd go, "Yeah, we all got speaking spells," and you'd go, "I got a Mr. Professor
or Little Professor,
Little Professor."
Did you know what the Little Professor
is? I've heard of it. I don't think I could point it out, though.
It's just a calculator.
Oh, okay.
Designed for kids 5 to 9, but it generated unsolved expressions and prompted you to answer questions and stuff.
Yeah. Jared, you guys know what I'm talking about. I'm just saying. It just seems like Tom's kind of an alternate kind of guy. You would have a thought. Like, if I came to you right now.
That was not a cool thing back then.
No.
That was like me having the Fox stuff from JCPenney instead of the Izod stuff.
Yeah, there's just something about it that's like Tomish, and I think that's good. There's nothing wrong with it. I admire it. I think it's great. Well, we all got our mainstream thing. Tom's got some other idea, and it makes you think. That's just you to a T.
I had really a Commodore 64, though. Darn it.
Oh, well, good. So did we. Brothers again. All right. Well,
always
excellent.
Have to be different.
Next month, we are doing It Happened One Night from 1934. I don't know anything about this at all.
I don't know that I would call it the first, but definitely the prototypical rom-com.
Okay.
This is the rom-com from which spawned all future rom-coms.
Let's see. Frank Capra film.
From 1934.
Yep. So it'll be our second Frank Capra movie.
Yeah, it's Frank Capra getting on the board, trying to catch Spielberg.
Who's in this? Should I know these people? Hold on. Happened One Night. Here we go. This includes your cast of thousands.
Oh, you know, little actor named Clark Gable.
Oh,
you
right.
You might have heard of him.
Claudette Colbert or Colbert.
Claudette Colbert. Yeah.
All right. Walter Connolly, Jason Thomas, and Roscoe Carnes.
Mm-hmm.
Don't know anybody but Clark Gable. So I'm into it.
You don't know Claudette Colbert?
No.
I would think of the two, you would know those two. And you'll recognize Walter Connolly. He's been in a bunch of stuff.
She doesn't ring a bell for me, but I don't know why. Hold on, I'm looking real quick to see. Yeah, I don't.
He was like he was just in everything. But he's one of those guys.
I like those guys. I'm into character actors. But anyway, we're going to watch that because we like to dip back into the old stuff, and it's considered one of the many best films of all time. And so we're going to watch it. That's next month on the Film Festival episode of Current Geek. Before we leave you today, though, we always like to remind you that there are other cool things going on, and Tom Merritt has some of those cool things going on, and he would like to describe them to you now. Tom, anything going on?
Yes, indeed. In fact, Molly Wood and I are back to podcasting again and very excited to keep doing it, but we need your help. It's a Thing is a chance for Molly and I to just talk about our favorite stuff we're observing in pop culture and try to relate it to the importance of being human. And it's a good time. You got to check it out. And if you could support us, that would be even cooler. You can get a commercial-free RSS feed and support the show. Become a member at patreon.com/itsathing.
Ah, very nice. Speaking of Patreon, this show is also supported by Patreon and your continuing efforts to support us. Go to go to currentgeek.com or go to patreon.com/currentgeek. Either one. They'll get you the link there. You'll be able to hop on over there and show your support today. Many have. We'd love it if you did. So please do check that out. That's going to do it for us. Don't forget, currentgeek.com is the website. You can leave us voicemails, 801-471-0462. Stick around for The Legal Geek. He's got more this week. And we'll be back next week with even more of Current Geek. That's going to do it for us. For me, for Tom, we'll see you next time.
Back to Legal Geek. This week we review a couple more recent branding battles regarding well-known tabletop games, with reviews of ongoing cases and issues involving Monopoly and Cards Against Humanity. We covered Hasbro last week and their copyright win over the Game of Life, and this week the gaming giant filed a trademark opposition to try and protect perhaps the most iconic brand of gaming, Monopoly. A Croatian company is trying to register Drinkopoly as a U.S. trademark, and it has been allowed by the U.S. Trademark Office. But as we've covered before, allowed applications published for a few weeks to give the public and other rights holders a chance to object before a trademark finalizes into a registration. That's what Hasbro did here. Hasbro is relying on its dominant market position to claim that despite the differences in the name, the Drinkopoly brand would lead to consumer confusion about the source of goods for that game. Hasbro can throw some amazing stats up there, like 220 million sets of the game being sold since 1934, and the Monopoly marks generating over $3 billion in sales of products in the last decade alone. Makes sense why they would spend a little cash being proactive to try and keep others out of the Opoly brand field. Hasbro has a good success rate in these trademark oppositions, but we'll keep our eyes on this challenge to see where it goes. Our second subject this week is the party game Cards Against Humanity, whose owners have become much more willing to challenge other competitors in court or at the trademark office in recent years. One such challenge wrapped up this week when the appeal board at the trademark office decided that Cards Against Humanity had a legitimate claim to oppose and stop the registration of a game expansion called Crabs Adjust Humidity. The Crabs expansion pack was released by Vampire Squid Cards 3 years after CAH came on the market, and the name and stylings were chosen as an absurdist rhyme of the original Cards Against Humanity name. Cards Against Humanity initially sent emails, granting some level of approval for Vampire Squid to sell the Crabs pack. However, these agreements began to break when CAH objected to Vampire Squid selling the Crabs expansion pack at Target in 2015, and then this opposition to a trademark filed the same year. The appeal judge ruled that while the two game names have very different literal connotations, the similarities in appearance, pronunciation, and overall commercial impression was too much to allow Crabs Adjust Humidity to coexist over Cards Against Humanity's objections. Furthermore, although you can lose the right to object to another trademark by acquiescing to it in the field, the court interestingly ruled that the early stage agreements to let Crabs Adjust Humidity be used in some markets was not an effective legal acquiescence to registration of the same trademark. This case may set a precedent that gets cited in many other contexts, where some initial approval of a competitor happens before a pullback occurs. So crabs for everyone in future trademark cases. Cards Against Humanity has won again, just like they did when pulling another competitor, Humanity Hates Trump, off the Kickstarter fundraising platform. Speaking of Kickstarter challengers to CAH, another knockoff-type adult card game called the Offensive Adult Party Game from a company called The Dragon's Tomb launched this week on the same platform. The game appears to use the same font and black and white card styles as Cards Against Humanity, which may be a bridge too far for a fair use defense. I'd expect another Kickstarter takedown from CAH here. The bottom line is, the most popular tabletop games are always at risk of competitors carving out places in the market with similar sounding names or trade dress. It is important for brand owners of valuable brands to protect and defend their turf, and that's why these gaming giants Hasbro and Cards Against Humanity will continue to fill this segment's coffers with interesting news stories to cover. Until next time, enjoy the gaming. Thanks for listening. Please provide feedback and segment suggestions to me on Twitter at BuckeyeFitzy.
This show is part of the Frog Pants Network.
Frog Pants Network.
Get more shows like this at frogpants.com.